is, today I'm just going to talk about one project that's got a few different manifestations, but it's all about these listening glass objects. I'm just going to go into the resonator for anybody who hasn't come across it before or read the stuff in the canteen. So Helmholtz resonators are hollow spheres of glass or brass, and they've got two points on either side. One is kind of conical, so you can put it directly in your ear, and the other side is an opening which helps to determine the resonant pitch of the vessel. They're designed by Helmholtz, and they're prosthetic tools, and the fact that they function by sympathetic resonance was the sort of one of the things that really intrigued me about them when I came across them in the study. Their purpose is to identify and quantify the partial tones in musical sound. So throughout the study on the sensations of tone, scientifically takes apart sort of vowel sounds to analyse the relative strengths of these partials, and also I think organ pipes and other things that you might consider to be musical anyway. And he explains how they're to be used. He says, if we're to stop one ear, which is festooned by sealing wax, and apply a resonator to the other, most of the tones produced in the surrounding air will be considerably dampened. But if the proper tone of the resonator is sounded, it brings into the ear most powerfully. It's quite interesting when he says, hence anyone, even if he has no ear for music or is quite unpracticed in detecting musical sounds, is put in a condition to pick specific tones out of a great number of others. So this for me was quite interesting, this idea of training the ear, which I'll go into a bit in a moment, but it was actually a kind of a little aside that I noticed. You know, this wasn't a big part of the study, but he just kind of revealed in the text that, you know, he said the proper tone of the resonator may even sometimes be heard cropping up in the whistling of the wind, the splashing of water, and the rumbling of carriage wheels on granite paving stones or something. But it was just this image of this kind of serious scientist taking the tools outside and quite visibly listening to, you know, sounds of world, non-musical sounds that I found quite interesting. So, it's this idea of trying to find music, sort of quite literally musical tones in the soundscape, and also being a very visible listener that I wanted to explore. Just a little bit more about this ear training thing that I find interesting. The resonators, when you see them, especially when they're displayed in a series, because they're often marked with the musical tone that they're tuned to as well, they kind of symbolise standardisation of tone. It's like, okay, this is, yeah, it's very specific, it's kind of quite authoritative, a bit like, yeah, they also remind me of minimalist installations as well, like they're trying to be, not trying to be anything other than they are, they're trying to be truthful. And also this idea of standardisation of tone, because I guess obviously Helmholtz is one of the people who's trying to get greater accuracy in sort of measuring the tone. But I also like to compare it to instruments like the stethoscope, which kind of symbolise a new scepticism with hearing itself. So there's this publication by Eric Lee Schmidt. I think it's called up at the bottom, Hearing Things, Religion, Illusion, and the American Enlightenment. And that's mainly about how sort of religion is controlled. Well, religion controls the senses in various different ways, of all senses. But you know, his study focuses on the ear and the various sort of moral connotations of these, of this management of the senses. So I think he also talks about the stethoscope as an instrument which the instruments kind of symbolising a new scepticism of hearing, anyway, when I can bring up. And something else I find interesting about Helmholtz's work and this act of taking these analytical tools outside. When he describes musical sounds, he uses words like simple, pleasurable, and periodic, in contrast to noises, which he says are non-periodic, irregularly mixed up and tumbled about in confusion. But the resonators, I think, help to show the interdependent relationship between the noise and music, you know, 5 years before Cage or whoever else. He demonstrates how noises can be compounded out of musical tones by sort of, uses the example of just hitting all the keys on a piano, but also that it can work in reverse. If you use the resonators to set, you know, if you play broadband noise, you can use the resonators to listen to the musical tones within the noise, so it kind of works both ways. Just thinking about sort of other more contemporary artists and how they're working, I think it's interesting to compare Helmholtz's act to people like Murray Schafer, who ask us to try and listen to the soundscape as if it were a musical composition. Because, I mean, on the face of it, it's quite, it's like he's trying to sort of open our minds to these sounds, but actually at the level of detail, the thing that annoys me a little bit about Schafer is that he's got a very clear idea about the kind of sounds that he wants in his soundscape. So he kind of mentioned that he hates all noises and how airplanes are sort of really bad. And yeah, and I quite like airplanes from where I live, at least they sound quite nice. So yeah. But the interesting thing about Schafer is he says that post-Cage, the main principle distinguishing music from noise is whether or not sound is intended to be heard. So this is his idea of what in the sort of contemporary world separates music from noise. Three manifestations of my work to do with resonators that I'm going to show. And this first one came out of a specific opportunity. It was an exhibition called Sound Escapes, which is part of the Positive Soundscapes Research Project, which was trying to bring together, you know, artists, scientists, just trying to get everybody working together on this idea of how we don't think about soundscapes anymore in terms of amplitude. You know, we forget about trying to measure the volume level of everything. It's more about the quality of experience and sort of promoting this idea of positive soundscape. And for that, I worked with a glass blower in London, who's a sort of scientific glass person, who made these new versions of the resonators. They're each marked with the tone that we tried to tune them to. I mean, I'm sure they're not 100% accurate, but they, yeah, I tried my best. And so the idea is that, well, the little pamphlet that I was showing in the canteen as well, that was on the side of the plinth, so people sort of have an idea about what they are. And they're invited to pick them up and wander around and listen to other pieces in the exhibition. Yeah, there's a lot of other sounding pieces in the gallery, and also a loud, you know, really horrible road outside, really noisy road that they're quite responsive to. So, that's that. But actually, it was kind of risky not playing anything specific to match the tone, because I didn't know exactly if there was going to be anything available in the exhibition that would, you know, necessarily make them work to their best. Show them in their best light, but actually I like the challenge of just offering these things, and because it kind of raises the question, well, what am I listening for, you know, and why? So I liked sort of giving the audience a bit of a challenge rather than presenting it on a plate. So I'm just showing here how ridiculous you look when you read. And also, this is kind of part of the series that I was trying to play in the canteen for you. So I consider it to be documentation, but I try to do it in a sort of sensitive way. So I'm recording through binaural microphones, and so one of them would be in my ear, and then the other one I would occasionally take it out and put it in a resonator and listen for a few minutes, and then take it out again. But keeping all this microphone noise in is part of the piece. So this is listening to water, traffic, and wind in the tree. And that's kind of what's documented in the canteen. And then the latest thing that I've done with them, I like this idea of taking a road noise and like using an equalizer, in the editing process, but using the physical object instead to just draw out 8 to 3 50 bands and work with those in a composition. This just shows the basic concept, because I'm really sort of always interested in how accurately we know whether we've actually listened to something in the same way. I mean, I guess it's the same with any kind of perception. I was wondering if people are seeing things in the same way. So this is kind of hence the title, Do You Hear What I Hear? Because I mean, in some way I see this as like the possibilities of everybody's listening, they could be picking out different aspects of the sound. So the idea was a bit like what was asked in the grass yesterday with the 6 speakers. I originally just wanted to play the sound back without any further editing, so I put one glass to a different speaker, so they're all sort of discrete channels. But because this space that was offered to me is like a really reverberant passageway, there was a lot of bleeding going on anyway. So you could really tell so much that there were discrete channels because of the echo. So instead I arranged the copying bit. So instead I just kind of moved the sound, these 8 different frequency bands of sound around the 8 speakers. So it's just, you kind of have to spend time in this. It's a slow moving cloud of tones and space. Spatial organisation. And this is just to give you some idea. It's not actually a recording of the place. It's just cycling through the different possibilities. Maybe, I don't know, because of
have made involving making different kinds of resonant bodies that are then used to modify, you know, sound in urban spaces, for example, which is, I guess, the example you've been giving. But I'm particularly interested and curious about when you say that you made binaural recordings, what does that mean for you exactly to have, what would be considered a binaural transduction system, which you're then modifying with some sort of glass resonator, and then when you're actually reproducing or reconfiguring the sounds that you gather in this way,
mm-hmm.
you know, what kind of space do you call that at that point? I don't mean that it needs to have a specific absolute name, but I'm sort of trying to understand what all of those kinds of decisions that you're making mean for you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the decision to use binaural microphones is like twofold. One is more interesting than the other. I mean, a practical reason is just because the holes are so small. I don't know of any other microphones that you could put inside. But also, I mean, one of the reasons why I became really interested in sound work in the first place is because I went on one of Janet Cardiff's walks, and even though, I mean, I don't know if anybody else has done one of her walks, but they're quite interesting for the way that she goes out and records binaurally, and then edits a narrative over the top, which is like multi-layered, you know, so it's not just one person, you're never quite sure who's talking, but actually, I don't like the narrative part so much. I just like being able to listen to the sounds that she recorded and follow her footsteps, because it's really confusing. You know, I really didn't know when I came to a road whether I was going to get, whether the car was really coming or whether it was on the soundtrack. So it was this kind of idea of, I knew about that effect of them, but they're kind of quite convincing in representing the space of the
But are you deliberately interested in this, a deliberate sort of misuse of the sort of reproduction of a binaural sound by kind of redistributing it spatially? Is that sort of where you're headed with when you do that? I'm not sure if I understand if you're making modified binaural recordings and then reproducing them in a non-binaural sense, you know, setup, or are you just, you know, it's
yeah, well, the binaural, like, for the like, through the listening process pieces, I say it's a kind of documentation. I only want people to listen to that on headphones,
right.
Because it only makes sense. That's why I didn't play it now, because it doesn't make any sense on stereo, because I really want you to feel the things going in your ear, you know, so it's a sense of, and that's why all the microphone scuffing is there, because when you're squeezing it in your ear, you can feel that when you're listening back on the big headphone. But when in Vienna, it was more the practical thing, but it's also quite interesting for me, because, I mean, the resonators also, I think they help to, they also demonstrate what Helmholtz is thinking about hearing itself. So I don't know, this connection with the binaural is about the ear, and you know, the resonators about the ear, so
okay, we have another question.
Yes, well, I listened to your installation and I took the left channel to be the reference,
mm-hmm.
the open one, so that I knew what the other ear was hearing filtered.
Mm-hmm.
The Helmholtz resonators are fairly sharp,
mm-hmm.
so they're quite slow in reacting,
mm-hmm.
And that is why noise will give the characteristic frequency of them, but it is not as strong as if you had a pure tone,
mm-hmm.
that you were aiming for,
mm-hmm.
then you would have a really strong resonance.
Yes, sure.
You could do the same thing, but it wouldn't be nearly as constructive,
mm-hmm.
as Helmholtz. Electronically, you could make ordinary binaural recordings and pass it through a filter, one channel, and you would get precisely the same effect,
mm-hmm.
basically, but it would not be working from basic principles,
mm-hmm.
which you're doing. And that's the fact, I think, the fascinating thing.
You know, I guess it's the act. I mean, it's not so much, I mean, the tools are interesting. When I saw the illustration, I was like, this is intriguing because it's a vessel, you know, there's all these little things about it. There's a Vesuvius with these vessels of tuning, like trying to tune it. I mean, it just kind of, all these references for me were in that picture, but I wouldn't have done a project if it wasn't for this
to that Helmholtz himself plugged up the other ear, because he was listening with one ear only. He didn't want the disturbance from the other ear.
Yeah, well, I've tried, you know, I've tried.
Yeah, that's a reference to us. Yes.
Yeah.
In the context of the broader practice you mentioned, in terms of, for instance, say, oh, it's a damn good job that there was a road, a noisy road outside the gallery, which is just a funny, I think it's an interesting statement from the perspective of acoustology in
right.
terms of the tradition of that. I think in terms of why doing it that way and not going to try and tone and so on, in terms of a divining tonal quality from amorphous, otherwise, you know, noise, it's kind of an interesting approach to a recordable listening.
Yeah, well, I mean, my supervisor, I'm like Don Juven, so I'm sort of familiar with this whole area. I mean, I find it really empowering, also a bit limiting at the same time as well, because I think a lot of people are starting to talk about their get worried about sort of moral overtones.
That's interesting that I didn't know he was a supervisor, because I was talking to him a couple of weeks ago, and he kind of brought up, we were talking about noise, and it's probably, it's just, oh, but of course, and Jacob said it's about health, and that's the conversation, which is a really funny thing to me. So it's kind of, which is interesting from what you're saying, or from some of this in the book, is that it doesn't really, because then it's just a question of amplitude again. So it's kind of nice.
I think about the physical form, Anders, from Kristianstad University. It's very, it has a very clear character. Did you think about experimenting with maybe changing the form, or maybe changing? You said you tried with one and you tried with two, and we laugh a bit because we can imagine how it looks with two. But I mean, really, if you should take it seriously, you could do a lot of, in an artistic sense, formative or in a fluxus way or whatever you like, but you could do a lot, work a lot with a physical form. How do you think about that?
Yeah, well, because I mean, before he talks about the spherical resonances, he also showed you all these other ones. I mean, wine bottle that looks like a wine bottle to me with a big bladder on the end of it. I mean, that's a different demonstration of resonance. But then tubes, you know, just how do you describe them? I don't know, circular tubes. So I mean, you could use anything. You could probably use sort of toilet rolls if you were to tune. You could, yeah.
Seashells.
Yeah, seashells. Well, I mean, there's a bit in my thesis where I write about the sort of an association that I was trying to do with the last piece as a kind of aeolian. Because, you know, it sounds like winds, and it's going through a passageway, so it's supposed to sound. But actually, there's this description somewhere of the aeolian harp. This theory by, I'll have to go in here to get the name, but probably 18th century person who's trying to describe the action of the wind harp. And he thinks that in the air around us are just musical tones the whole time, but the harp helps to separate out these tones into the different frequency bands. So this is kind of really interesting for me, because it sounds like, yeah, I mean, if you substitute air for noise, it's
a quick comment. There's an excellent discussion between